10. The Rapture as Low Burlesque, July 3rd, 2015. This is the morning that I have been promised. I open my eyes from a dream that seems more real and brighter and louder than any waking memory, and dimly I recall that this is the morning. I lie in my bunk and watch a galaxy of dust motes sifting through a shaft of sunlight. Here, on the 6,997th day since my birth, to a woman whose face I can now hardly even recall. The mother of my body, the mother of my captivity. Chloe, you are such a beautiful, beautiful baby. I thought you were a gift from the angels, and I couldn't imagine what I had possibly done to have deserved you. I stare at that shaft of light slipping in through the tattered drapes, and the dream of the home that was never home slowly begins to fray, admitting this day instead. This day, 6,977 days after I was shat out, mewling and soft, into a gallery of daggers and broken glass. I wish Drew had been there with me in the dream. I wish he could have spoken to my mother, and then she could have prepared me for this day. She would have known what I was made for. I might never have strayed from the path, seduced by the ways of wolves and smack and hypodermic solace. I might never have become someone who needed to be cut free from the belly of the beast. The air stirs and the dust motes swirl. I thought that there would be pain when this morning arrived, but there's almost no pain at all. My mouth tastes like the air in a cellar, and my head is filled with bees. I should get up. I should get up and go find the others. Last night, Drew drove me down to Bombay Beach, and we sat in his car and listened to the engine cooling and the desert cooling and the black expanse of Jaikan breathing in and out, out and in. We parked at the shore near the rusting shell of an old school bus sunk almost up to its windows in the salt and the evaporite muck and the bones of dead tilapia and pelicans. We sipped vodka from a paper bag, and he watched my eyes while I watched the starlight pinpoints shimmering above the sea.
"What do you espy away up there, little Chloe?"
"I see fire," I told him. It was the truth. "I see the black fire that's been burning almost forever, and I see the spheres that move through the flames. I see the tiny boat we've launched, and I see that other boat sailing out to meet us halfway." He smiled, and then he laughed a small laugh, and that's when I remembered Madeline was sitting in the back seat. She lit a cigarette, and for a few moments the night smelled less like dead fish and brine and more like matches.
"You see all that?" she asked.
"Yeah," I said. I'm not afraid of Madeline, but sometimes I have thought that she wishes Drew had never found me in that alleyway. I think maybe she's decided I've come to steal away her Titan for my own.
"What else do you see, little Chloe?"
Drew asked. "Towers. I see towers. Like an old movie about Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves, or Sinbad the Sailor. A city of spiraling towers and crystal domes. A city in a desert of ebony sand. A desert at the edge of an ocean. But it's not like any ocean we know. There aren't any waves. There aren't tides. It's as flat and still as a mirror, Drew. It's as flat and still as glass. And it isn't water, either. It's an ocean of methane, ethane, propane. Sometimes I see mighty storms that march furiously across that ocean and march across the ebony desert and bury the city beneath blizzards of benzene snow. And I wonder at the words falling from my lips, because I comprehend they're not precisely, not entirely, my own. I am a vessel, prepared for a new purpose, and the messengers are free to speak through me. My eyes, my brain, my mouth. But the messengers are translators, intermediaries weaving my dumbstruck thoughts into the tapestry that Drew needs to hear. For I have gazed in sleep on things my memory scarce can keep."
"You're my little poet," he said,
then turns on the car radio. There's a Beatles song playing, and I know that Drew knew there would be. In the back seat, Madeline made a sound that I might only mistake for derisive. "Am I awake?" I asked.
"Love," he said. "That's nothing you should ever worry yourself about again. Waking and sleeping, you found your way through the cavern of flame, and now you stand at the top of the 700 steps. For you, the distinction between dream and waking thought has begun to implode, folding in upon itself. You've become a singularity to dissolve everything that separates the one from the other."
And then he asked me to tell them a story, he and Madeline, and so I told him the story about the princess and her onyx tower, and the sword forged of lamentation, and the tall, pale woman who was her lover and then became her champion. I told them about the dragon at the gate and the whispers below the mountains. I should get up. It's hot, and it must be very late morning by now. It would be so easy to lie here in the sweltering day, even though my anxious excitement tugs at my belly, at the very centermost parts of me. The others will be waiting. Drew and Madeline left before dawn, and now it all falls to me. Now it all falls on me. I have been entrusted with the future, and here I am, lying in bed half the damn day, getting turned around in my thoughts when there's so much still to be done. I sit up, and the alarm clock across the room says it's only 8:47, and I breathe a grateful sigh of relief. The house is quieter than it's ever been. "What if I'm not ready?" I asked Drew the night before, sitting there by the sea in his little red wagon, and he laughed and kissed my cheek. "You're ready," he said. "You're more ready than you can imagine. But you won't be the first." And my head jerked around then, as if I'd been stung, as if a bee or a wasp had slipped under my t-shirt and stung me in some especially vulnerable spot. I stared back over my shoulder at Madeline and the soft glow of her cigarette, but she was watching the sky, not me, and she hadn't said a word.
"It's okay," said Drew. "In all the wide, wide universe, there's no one in whom I have more faith than you."
"They'll go before you, the 13, one by one by one, and you will only be an afterthought, dragged along in their wake, tardy, almost forgotten." Madeline tapped ash on the floorboard, and Drew asked me to finish my story. It would be the last story I'd ever tell him, and he wanted to hear all the way to the end. "And as I look, I fain would know the paths whereon thy dream steps go, the spectral realms that thou canst see, with eyes veiled from the world and me." I never imagined a house could be this quiet. My sweat has stained the sheets yellow, and I push them onto the floor. It's not the first time I've seen that stain, but it's the first time it's ever struck me as unclean. I lean over and shove the dirty sheets beneath the bed, only half understanding that what I feel is not only revulsion, but shame, too. Like waking from a dream of bleeding to the shock of my first period, and rose petals spread across the linen. No, never mind. Not like that at all. I get to my feet, going slowly because the dizziness is worse this morning. No surprise there. I knew it would be. There should be no surprises whatsoever today. It's all dot to dot, paint by number from here. This map before me is not terra incognita. I only have to fill in the blanks, and I've spent months learning the answers. I was born knowing the answers 6,997 days ago, but must have been so terrified at the truth of it all that I did my best to forget. That was the road to an alleyway between 93rd and 94th Streets in Westmont. Desolation Row, Detonation Boulevard, the Road of Needles, the fucking path of least resistance. The coward's way. But the willful scales fell from my eyes on the road to my own private Damascus. Drew's Damascus. The television white noise Damascus, where the messengers sing from cathode ray tubes. 1 foot in front of the other. That's all it takes. Go to the 13 now and be sure everything is just exactly as it ought to be. You're the 14th, and you're also the midwife. There can be no greater honor, can there? Make certain that each crosses at her or his appointed time, that they all bloom and spread themselves to the winds blowing down from the chocolate mountains. The star winds, the mighty Coachella Scirocco. And only when each has folded open may I sit down and follow their examples. The very last, I hear Madeline whisper. By the time you arrive, little afterthought, the deed will be done. The parade will have come and gone. But don't be sad. Every revolution needs a rear guard just in case. Someone will be thankful, I'm sure. In the hallway between the kitchen and the television room, that's when I see the shotgun. It's always been there, the break-top double-barrel 12-gauge that Drew said he got cheap off some bikers up in San Bernardino. To keep away the coyotes, he said, though I'd never seen a coyote come anywhere near Moonlight Ranch. I don't know what the fuck they'd even eat out here. I've never even seen a jackrabbit or an armadillo either. And it's not like coyotes can eat creosote bushes or cacti. I check to see if the shotgun's loaded, pushing back the latch to open the breech. I can't recollect just when I learned to do that, but maybe Drew taught me right after I came here, in case there were coyotes. I find two shells in the gun, and didn't Madeline tell me there were more in a kitchen cupboard? What are you doing, Chloe? What the fuck do you think you're doing? I find the extra shells, and I carry the gun with me when I go to the television room. All the others, they're too far along for the bunks, and so they've slept here, bathed in the salt and pepper light of the television, wrapped in the lullaby voices buried deep in the static since the Big Bang was new. My 6,997 days, the cosmos 13.7 billion years, this planet's 4.5 billion years. I never used to have a head for facts and figures, but the messengers have brought so many gifts. The room is becoming a garden, and it's my job to see that the flowers open out the doors, not inside this stifling room. They would be wasted here. What good is a rose that no one ever sees or smells? What are you doing? I won't even remember pulling the trigger. I know that. I am absolutely certain of that. Just as I'm certain that I'll also have no doubt whatsoever that I did. It isn't fair that I should be the last, not when I'm his favorite. I know that, and Madeline knows too. It was always a part of his plan, she whispers behind my eyes. But not a part that even he fully understands. It's like that, you know. Sometimes even prophets need a helping hand, just like Judas helped Jesus. Maybe you've never been a Christian, never gone to church or prayed, but I bet you know that story. I bet you understand that analogy. So don't you worry your pretty head. You won't be last after all. It wouldn't have been fair. I find them all right where they ought to be, and the gun cracks the day like an egg.